This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in this week for Terry Gross. You might recognize Tom McCarthy from any number of his film or television roles. On the HBO series The Wire, he played the ambitious newspaper reporter who made up stories in the show's final season. He also appeared in Boston Public, Law & Order, and the films Flags of Our Fathers, Syriana, and Good Night and Good Luck. But McCarthy's also written and directed two films which won critical praise: The Station Agent, starring Peter Dinklage and Patricia Clarkson, and The Visitor, a story about a man who encounters two immigrants in New York, which featured Richard Jenkins in his first starring role. Critic David Rooney says McCarthy has a rare ability to shape unexpected connections among very real people, guiding them towards gently uplifting outcomes that are neither manipulative nor sentimental. That, Rooney adds, might make him one of the least cynical filmmakers in America. McCarthy's new film is Win-Win, starring Paul Giamatti as a small-town lawyer who's a high school wrestling coach on the side. Struggling to support his family, the lawyer takes an ethical shortcut which involves him in the life of an elderly client. And things get complicated when the old man's teenage grandson shows up, a refugee from his drug-addicted mom. In this scene, Giamatti is talking to the teenager, played by Alex Schaefer, who's shown a special talent and become the unexpected star of the wrestling team. The team has just broken its season-long losing streak, and player and coach are walking down a school hallway, their down coats rustling as they speak.
Proud of what you did today. That win meant a lot to the guys.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something, Kyle. What's it like to be as good as you are? What does that feel like?
I don't know. I guess it just feels like I'm in control of everything, you know?
Yeah, I do. Must be nice.
It is.
Well, Tom McCarthy, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about Win-Win, the new film. You know, at the heart of this story is this small-town lawyer who has a struggling practice dealing mostly with older clients. The story kind of begins with this lawyer and his family and then gets more complicated. How did this script begin to you?
I think ultimately this whole idea began with me calling an old high school, an old, not even high school, grade school friend, Joe Taboni, who I've known since I was in fourth grade. And we started reliving our high school not-so-glory days and just laughing a lot about it. And by the end of the conversation, I thought, you know, there's something in here that's worth writing about. And I actually invited Joe to develop the story with me. He's actually an elder law attorney who lives in New Providence and is married with two little girls, a little bit like Mike Flaherty is in the movie.
This young man who shows up, he is a kid in need of rescuing. And he becomes a really important character here, and he's played by Alex Schaefer. Where did you find him?
I decided early on in this project we needed to have a wrestler. There's a wrestling storyline to the movie, high school wrestling, and it's a really difficult sport to fake. And my casting director, basically did a massive casting call in the tri-state area looking for wrestlers under 5'5 and wrestling under 125 pounds because I wanted a specific type. And we saw a bunch of young men who came in and read for the role, and Alex Schaefer kind of came in and just in some unique way connected with. He's a non-actor, but he just connected with this character, and we really put him through the ringer in terms of auditioning him. But he kept rising to the challenge, and he ultimately gives a great performance in the film.
Yeah, when you first meet him, I mean, when you see the blonde hair and that kind of withdrawn affect, you think, this is a damaged kid. I'm not sure if he wanted to live with me, I'd want to have anything to do with him. And then it turns out there's a lot more going on, and he has this incredible work ethic and discipline.
Yeah, and more importantly, he has a code. And I think that's something that the film really deals with is, you know, we can only be regulated as adults in so many ways, whether that's on a city, state, or federal level. Ultimately, it's got to come about as a personal responsibility and regulation. And this young man shows up with that he's obviously derived from wrestling. And it's this code that he brings with him of what's right and wrong and how to proceed through life. And he makes his way. Now, he makes mistakes. He does dumb things. We see and hear about them in the film. He's a young man. Of course he's going to do that. And he comes from a tough background. But he still, you have a sense he has this sort of moral compass, which you just kind of get from Alex. And that's something that you can't, that's tough to play. Either a character has that or he doesn't.
I read that you were a wrestler in high school along with your friend Joe, right? Yeah.
I was. Yeah. I was a killer, Dave. I'm not going to lie.
I was just going to ask you, were you good?
I was 101 pounds of mean. That's what I wrestled. I wrestled 101 and 108. I was okay. I was fair, maybe slightly above average. And Joe also wrestled. He wasn't quite as successful. It's one of those sports you look back on, you sometimes think, why did I do that? It was so much pain. But it's just, you know, you get into it. I got into it at an early age, and it kind of stuck.
Do you think wrestling gave you something, like a work ethic, a discipline that helped you get where you are?
Yeah, it probably did. I think sports in general provide that. And I think wrestling specifically, because it's just such a tough sport. Just to get through a season, you feel like you accomplished something. And there really is this thing about just going out onto a mat and taking a guy on, just one-on-one, with a set of rules applied. But ultimately, it is that. I think it toughens you up and gives you that sense of, I can kind of take on any problem.
Well, I wanted to talk about The Station Agent, which you wrote and directed in 2003, won a bunch of awards. And this is a story of a man named Finn, who is played by Peter Dinklage. He's a dwarf, as it turns out, who is a train buff and worked for years in a model train store. But when the owner dies and the shop closes, he discovered he's inherited a defunct train station in a remote part of New Jersey. And he goes there and settles in. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here, where he is befriended by a guy who has a hot dog stand nearby named Joe, played by Bobby Cannavale. And Joe really wants to make friends. Finn, not so sure. Let's listen.
Hey, Finn. Bro, you live here?
Yes.
Wow, we're neighbors. Nice. Hey, what happened to you?
Nothing.
Listen, you want to go down to the mill and grab a beer later?
No, thanks.
Well, you don't drink?
I do.
Well, you just don't want to have a drink with me?
I don't like bars very much.
Oh. Hey, well, how about I go get a six and we can have it right here?
No, thanks.
Well, what are you going to do?
I'm going for a walk.
Oh, cool. Well, you mind if I come along, man? I need the exercise. I'm turning into a fat out here.
I usually go alone.
Well, I'm a good walker, bro.
Prefer to go alone.
Okay. All right, maybe next time, right? You know where to find me.
And the irrepressible Joe, that's Bobby Cannavale and Peter Dinklage in the film The Station Agent, directed and written by our guest, Tom McCarthy.
I haven't heard that in a long time.
It's fun, isn't it? Yeah.
It is fun. Those two guys are really fun to watch together. And as you were kind of laying out the storyline, I was thinking to myself, boy, I keep making these movies that are really hard to define in a story. They sound very inaccessible the way they lay out sometimes. But anyway, I was getting a kick out of that as you were trying to make your way through it.
And the lead, Peter Dinklage here. Now, I read that you did not envision him in the role. You saw yourself in the role. Is that right?
I think at some time, look, I was like an actor trying to get roles, and I started to write a script, and who better to play it than me?
Right.
And then halfway through it, I thought, I'm not really right for this, which probably tells you a little bit about my acting career. Really, I almost finished an entire draft without envisioning Pete or a dwarf playing that role. And then I ran into Pete just randomly on the street in New York one day. I had directed him in a play a couple of years prior to that, and thought he was a terrific actor. And right after our conversation, I was walking away, I was like, there's my guy. There's a guy just visually will understand someone who might want to disconnect a little bit from society, which ultimately is what the movie deals with. And that idea stuck. I called Pete the next day, and I sat down to write it, and it really informed the script thematically in a really wonderful way.
Right. And how much of it was because of his particular...
Ultimately, it didn't change things that much. Literally, it was like bit by bit. It was just almost like I didn't need exposition. I didn't need a backstory about, you know, with this character. And that's something I'm always trying to avoid. Now, I'll just let the audience fill in the blanks because it's probably more interesting to some degree than having it preached to them. And with Pete and Bobby, of course, and Patty Clarkson, who played the other role, a lot of their backstory, we just get little bits and pieces of it. I'm much more concerned with how these three people move into the present together and form this sort of odd triumvirate.
I wanted to talk about The Visitor, which was your second film, also very well received and a terrific movie. Deals with a kind of a lonely economics professor and his encounter with to illegal immigrants. You know, Richard Jenkins got a lot of attention for this role, got an Oscar nomination. He's been an actor that people would recognize from a lot of roles over the years. He was the deceased dad on the HBO series 6 Feet Under. Why did you come to cast him for this role?
You know, it's a similar to reason for why I cast Paul Giamatti in Win-Win. I think both of these actors present a face and just an essence that audiences can relate to immediately as a neighbor, you know, as a family member, as the guy next door, the guy on the street, and sort of this everyman quality. I know that's a bit of an overused term, but they really have that. Maybe there's something that they're not conventional leading men in that sense. So I feel like there is makes them more accessible to audiences. Plus, you know, Richard was just overdue. He's just a tremendous actor. He's done so many movies. Audiences have seen him for years. And I just felt like he certainly had the range. And in both the case of Richard Jenkins and Paul Giamatti and Win-Win, and even Peter Dinklage in The Station Agent, all those men have this tremendous sense of vulnerability, which I always find very appealing in male characters.
One of the things about this film, a lot of what we're seeing is actors reacting.
Acting.
I was going to say, reacting and reflecting. Yeah. A lot of it's not what they're saying, it's what you're seeing in their faces. Does that require a different kind of directing?
The stillness between lines, it creates tension. It creates its own kind of tension. And I think that there doesn't always have to be words there for a scene to work. And again, you have to have the actors who can pull that off. I don't think it's any coincidence that all three of the leading men we've talked about today have tremendous stage experience in terms of the theater. Richard didn't even do his first film until I think he was 43 or 44. He was up at Trinity Rep, running the Trinity Rep and acting as a main company member up there. And these men have a tremendous sense of filling space in the subtlest ways. You know, certainly Paul Giamatti, same thing. Paul and I met at the Yale Drama School. He came out, he was doing Broadway and theater before he got into movies. And you can feel that with these guys. They're very comfortable. Once they're in their bodies, that's it. They lock in, and it just makes them incredibly compelling to watch.
Because when you're on stage, you're listening.
You're completely involved. There are no breaks. You're just up there. So and I think listening is a great thing to pick up on. I think that's what great actors do almost better than anything else. You mentioned reacting. I think part of that is listening. A big part of that is listening and being a good listener. And I think you can always tell a great actor because no matter what's happening in the scene, they're dialed in and they're responding. And it's informing not only the moment, but the moments down the line. It's fun to watch.
Well, you've done a lot of acting, and you had a major role in the 5th season of the HBO series The Wire. This is the last season where the series hones in on the flaws of urban journalism. And why don't you describe your character, Scott Templeton? He's a reporter at the Baltimore Sun.
Greatly misunderstood reporter of, he's probably ambitious before all else. And I think he's very career minded. And, you know, I think David Simon beat into me during when we were shooting The Wire, the 5th season. This guy's not a bad guy. He's not a bad guy. He's done nothing wrong. And of course, he was just pushing me to play against type and to play the reality of the moment, which is a young man who's trying to further his career by any means necessary. And unfortunately, in doing so, he crosses a few journalistic lines.
Making things up, right?
the old making things up. So right. Shoot me. But, you know, it was such an enjoyable experience playing that character because every week, you know, I had no idea. David just called me. He offered me the role. We had a brief conversation, and he said, I just think you're going to be really right for this character. Well, you know, as the season develops and I realize the guy's the biggest creep in all 5 seasons of The Wire, and I think I don't know if there's a more disliked character than Scott Templeton, makes me reflect back on just what it is David Simon saw in my own character that he's so connected with.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask that. What made you write for that? Do you know?
I do not know. I have thought about it long and hard since that. But yeah, the great thing about it is as the season's unfolding, you got more and more of a sense of just what happens to the character. It just starts to build, and it was a lot of fun to play. Watch this guy desperately try to hang on, and ultimately succeed in doing so, which is classic Simon. Never goes where you think he's going to go.
Right. Well, let's listen to one scene. And this is one where your character, Scott Templeton, has gone to a homeless encampment under an interstate in Baltimore, where, of course, the series is set. and spoken to an Iraq war vet and written about his experiences. And the scene we're going to hear is where the Iraq war vet has come storming into the newspaper claiming that your character, Scott Templeton, has gotten parts of it wrong. And this is a meeting with the Iraq war vet, who's played by Aubrey Deeker, and you as the reporter, Scott Templeton. It's mediated by your editor, who's played by Clark Johnson. Let's listen.
I never said I was in a firefight. Not on that day.
I'm sorry, but you did.
I told you the lead vehicle took a hit from an elevated IED, killed the 50 gunner, and blew the hands off the driver. That's it. That's enough, man. Why are you going to make the rest of that up?
I didn't make anything up. We sat there having coffee.
Coffee?
Having donuts and coffee. And you said...
What'd I say?
Can I finish?
I don't know. I'm hearing about coffee and donuts. I'm not hearing...
Can I finish? If you're not going to let me tell my side of the story...
A lie ain't a side of the story. It's just a lie.
I don't have to listen to this.
Okay, hey, Scott, let's just relax here. Both gentlemen, let's just step back here, please. Now, Mr. Henning, forgive me, but do you drink much?
You think I sleep under a bridge sober?
Well, sometimes when I have a few, and I do like to have a few, I tend to be a little more descriptive in the telling of a tale. In fact...
I know what it is to tell a story. I've told plenty in my time. But there's some things that happen, you don't ever with them.
Scott?
I believe you, Mr. Hanning. I believe that you believe. That you believe you told me one thing. But, sir, with all due respect and gratitude for you and the service you gave to this country, you didn't tell me that thing. You told me something else. I wrote what Mr. Hanning told me.
And that's Tom McCarthy, our guest, in a scene from the fifth season of The Wire, where he plays a reporter who stretches the bounds of ethics, shall we say, at the Baltimore Sun. You know, you've said that in five seasons of The Wire, there may not be a more contemptible character than your guy. Does it follow you around? Do people see you and say,
absolutely. People are really vocal about that. That show has a very, you know, just walking through your offices here, which feel a little bit like a newsroom, I started to get that itchy feeling that someone was going to launch a stapler at me or something. And, you know, even on the streets in New York, I have people all the time who will just walk by me and be like, you're a bad man. You know, they just, and I know, the sad thing is I know what they're talking about. I was sitting down by their river one day and enjoying the sunset with my girlfriend, and three guys walk by in suits, and the one guy just looks at me and goes, someone should knock you out. And I knew what he was talking about, and they all kind of cracked up, and he's like, I'm right. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. People really don't like Scott Templeton. It's a lot of fun to play a character like that, and the reaction continues to be fun. I mean, even when I'm doing press tours right now for Win-Win, I'm going around, and a lot of people are still putting together that I'm that guy, and I walk into a room, and the temperature changes a bit when they realize they're in the presence of Scott Templeton. Pulitzer Prize-winning Scott Templeton, I should say.
Right. You know, you've done three movies now, and the first two were highly acclaimed, and I'm confident the third one is going to be well-received as well. The reviews are good. And you've done three movies. None of the characters are famous or powerful. Nobody's been stabbed, shot, or blackmailed. Can you keep this up?
I don't know. It is funny. I do get that a little bit. I don't know what it is. I definitely am interested in the ordinary becoming extraordinary in some way and trying to find that and challenging myself. Look, I think with Win-Win, specifically I was delving back into suburban New Jersey. I knew that was going to be a challenge because the world is so conventional by design. And, you know, in many ways, this is my most personal film because it's, you know, set in the town I grew up in, developed the story with one of my oldest friends, and it deals with issues I care about. But it was like, how to make this compelling for an audience? And, you know, I think our answer to that was keep it fun, keep it entertaining. And it's really what I wanted to do this film. It's a much busier film than my other films. Mike Flaherty is in the midst of his life. You know, he's got his family he's committed to. He's got his practice. He's a wrestling coach. He's got more than enough going on. That was the challenge for this script, how to make that operate and how to make it exciting for audiences.
All right. Well, Tom McCarthy, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Tom McCarthy wrote and directed the new film Win-Win, starring Paul Giamatti and Amy Ryan. It opens Friday. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, and for Terry Gross. Writer and journalist Anne Royfe made her name as a voice of the women's movement. Her 1970 novel Up the Sandbox was hailed as a feminist classic. Of late, Royfie's been writing memoirs on such topics as marriage and old age. Her latest memoir, Art and Madness, is a fierce recollection of her youth in the literary New York of the 1950s and early 60s. The memoir includes an introduction by Royfie's well-known writer daughter, Katie. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Towards the end of her ego-shredding new memoir called Art and Madness, Anne Royfie tells the jaw-dropping story of the day her first child was born. It was 1960, and a snowstorm was raging in New York City. Royfie, 9 months pregnant, has shuffled over to Third Avenue to a repair store to pick up her husband's typewriter. That husband, a playwright named Jack Richardson, is snug at home, sleeping off a night out on the town. Royfie wants him to have his typewriter nearby, should inspiration strike when he awakens. So she picks it up at the store, balances its weight against her swollen belly, and starts trudging through the snow 15 blocks back to their apartment. On the way, her water breaks. She reaches a payphone and calls her husband. He doesn't wake up to answer. No taxis are around, so Royfie stumbles on, all the way to the hospital, typewriter clasped like a religious relic in her arms. I say that anecdote is jaw-dropping because it is, viewed through the feminist-inflected lens of 2011. But here's how powerful a writer that masochistic young woman came to be. Because even as we contemporary readers may be tisk-tisking over Royfie's martyrdom, she also transports us deep into the mindset of a handmaiden of literature circa 1960. Reading that passage, I was anxious at the thought of Royfie going into labor in a snowdrift. But because of the way Royfie draws me into the scene, I was simultaneously anxious about that damn typewriter and wondering if maybe she shouldn't have dropped it off with the doorman at her apartment house for safekeeping before she lumbered on alone to the hospital. Art and Madness is a particularly hard-boiled addition to a distinct subgenre of female autobiography. Memoirs written by women who came of age in the 1950s and who sublimated their own ambitions by attaching themselves to literary men. I'm thinking of testaments like How I Became Hetty Jones by the eponymous former wife of Leroy Jones, later Amiri Baraka, Manhattan When I Was Young by Mary Cantwell, and the especially magnificent Minor Characters by Joyce Johnson, one-time girlfriend of Jack Kerouac. Educated at Seven Sisters Colleges or their like, these young women wanted to live for art, which in the 1950s translated into living for a man who thought of himself as an artist. They found a place for themselves in the New York boho scene of the time, pouring drinks or tending to the other appetites of the resident drunken geniuses. Royfie, who married right after graduating from Sarah Lawrence and was divorced from her playwright about 6 years later, was a smart party girl in the Norman Mailer, George Plimpton literary lion pack. Analyzing the marriage of Doc Humes, who co-founded the Paris Review, and his wife, Royfie coldly illuminates the 1950s allure of the great man. He was a writer, a famous writer, with famous writer friends, and that made him special, far more appealing than a banker or a lawyer. He was an artist, and she would bear his children and wash his clothes and care for him, because there lay her own immortality. There lay her own contribution to the great effort to speak the truth, to shape the words, to write the novel that by existing would justify the human endeavor. I know this because I felt it too, all of it. Art and Madness is presented in shards of memories, mostly dating from the 1950s and early 60s. Royfie evokes the limited courage of her younger self. She was gutsy enough as a college girl to drive alone into New York, to perch herself on bar stools at writers' hangouts like the West End. but not yet brave enough to respect her own talent. What especially sets Art and Madness apart from its autobiographical sorority sisters is its mercilessness. After Royfie describes her husband leaving her for good, she says, "I have no pity for her, the still young woman helping her fleeing husband pack his shirts into a suitcase. I have no pity for that about-to-be-divorced woman who had been ready to live off the written words of someone else." Searing words that attest to the courage Royfie eventually did discover in herself, thanks in part to the Second Women's Movement. And yet, reading Royfie's tough comments, I can't help but feel that she's still lugging around more than her share of the historical burden.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Art and Madness by Anne Royfie. Coming up, we remember composer Hugh Martin, who died last week. This is Fresh Air. We've made it an occasional holiday tradition on Fresh Air to visit with Hugh Martin and play his song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Hugh Martin died Friday at his home in California. He was 96. Martin's best known for that song and two others, The Trolley Song and The Boy Next Door, all from the 1944 MGM musical Meet Me in St. Louis. Martin shared credit on his songs with longtime collaborator Ralph Blaine, who died in 1995. They met in the late 30s as performers, singing in Broadway musicals. Besides composing melodies and lyrics, Martin did arrangements for stage and movie productions, including Judy Garland's 1954 film A Star Is Born. He continued working into the 1980s, when he and Blaine teamed up for a Broadway revival of Meet Me in St. Louis with several new songs. Terry spoke to Hugh Martin twice. The first time was in 1989 with his collaborator Ralph Blaine.
Can you tell me the story of how you both teamed up together?
Yes, Ralph, you tell it.
I'll tell you the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me.
Me too.
I was hired by Kay Thompson, the fabulous Kay Thompson.
Oh, she is wonderful.
She is wonderful.
The greatest.
And she put us together in her rhythm singer group that was going to be in Hooray for What. She was starring with Ed Wynn in a Broadway musical called Hooray for What. And we were in the chorus together, and we met there. The greatest thing that ever happened to me was that in Boston, Kay left the show, and Hugh got to finish the vocal arrangements that had to be done. And it started a whole career of vocal arrangements for Broadway shows. And
we were actually devastated that Kay was that they'd let Kay go, because she was marvelous.
I thought so, too.
They were crazy to let her go, because she's one of the great ladies. Kay taught me everything I know about music and arranging. She's just marvelous.
And Hugh Martin taught me everything I know.
Meet Me in St. Louis, the film, was directed by Vincent Minnelli. Did he have any suggestions about how he wanted to get into the songs?
Oh, boy. He sure did.
He's a perfectionist.
Brilliant suggestions.
Can you give an example?
The best example, I think, is that when we wrote the Trolley Song and everyone had loved it, Vincent came up with the idea that he wanted it sung by the chorus before Judy sang it, which sounded terrible to me. I couldn't understand why he wanted that. It just seemed wrong to me. But now seeing the movie, I can see how beautifully that idea worked out, of having the chorus kids come in on the car and set up the whole melody and lyric idea.
And then John Truett, the boy next door, dashing and trying to catch the trolley, and she's so thrilled that he's trying to make it and does finally at the end.
He masterminded all of that, and he was wonderful, wonderful director.
Now, I want to play a version of the Trolley Song. Now, this is a song that's kind of owned by Judy Garland in a way,
yeah,
as a singer. But on this version, we're going to hear Hugh Martin singing it, and this
How
is
nice.
From an album that Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine made together in 1957.
I'm very flattered, thank you.
Let's give it a listen.
Okay.
With her high starched collar and her high topped shoes and her hair piled high up on her head, she went to find a jolly hour on the trolley and found my heart instead. With my light brown derby and my bright green tie, I was quite the lonesomest of men. I started to yen, so I counted to ten, then I counted to ten again. Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. zing, 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 let my heart strings. For the moment I saw her, I fell. Chug, chug, chug went the motor. Bop, bop, bop went the brake. Thump, thump, thump went my heart strings. When she smiled, I could feel the car shake.
Hey, Martin, I like your singing a lot.
Oh, bless you, Terry.
Do you still sing?
You know, just your playing the record has given me the old itch to sing again. I'm going to go home and do my vocal eases. Thank you for playing it.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with the clang clang lyric?
Well, after we had written three different songs for Arthur Freed, which we thought would be corny to be about a trolley, I mean, we thought that we'll write something wonderful for Judy to sing on the trolley. And we did three different songs, which he said, I know, oh, I love it, it's a beautiful song, but I've got a better place for it, I'm going to use it in The Follies.
Which he never did. It was a tactful way of throwing them out, and I'm so glad he did.
And finally he says, now about the trolley song, I want you to try again for me. And I said, Hugh, he's not going to take anything less than a trolley, about a song about the trolley. So I went to the public library in Beverly Hills and was rummaging through some old turn-of-the-century newspapers and found a picture of a double-decker trolley, which they incidentally used in the movie. And under the trolley picture said, clang, clang, here comes the trolley. And I said, Hugh, look at this. And Hugh said, clang, clang, clang went the trolley. And about was very few minutes, he had the whole thing going. In fact, it didn't take long to write that song at all once we got the first line.
It was exactly 3 hours. Can you believe it?
We were in Freed's office demonstrating it in 3 hours.
Yeah.
And he said,
so
no, that's what I wanted all the time.
We're so excited.
He knew what he wanted.
That's great.
And you know, oh, this is interesting about the verse. Remember, Ralph, I called up Irene Sheriff, who had done the costumes for the film, and I said, Irene, could you tell me what Judy might be wearing in this scene? And she said, why do you want to know? And I said, well, we're working on this new song for the trolley, and I might be able to work in some of those phrases if I know what they wore in those days. And she said, well, it might be, she might have on a high-starched collar, she might have on high-top shoes. And I said, might her hair be piled high upon her head? And she said, yes, it might. And well, I said, might the boy be wearing? And she, you know, I practically set her words to music from
right.
the costume description.
And then when the picture was made, her hair was hanging down, not piled
yeah.
upon her head.
That's right.
He was wearing
right.
a straw hat, not a brown derby.
They screwed us up again.
didn't do a thing that the lyric said. We're doing it in the show.
But it made a nice verse.
Yes.
Well, I want to play you, Ralph Blaine, singing something from the Martin and Blaine album, again recorded in 1957. And why don't we listen to you singing The Boy Next Door, one of the songs that you both wrote for
Meet
Me in St. Louis.
Good. He does that beautifully.
Do you want to say anything about writing the song before we hear it?
Boy Next Door? No, it was just one of those melodies that really I'm so grateful for, because it really just came out of the blue, and then we put lyrics to it. There's nothing really special. Oh, there's one little special thing about it. After it was more or less finished, I asked Ralph if he thought it needed any finishing touches, and he said, why don't you work the address into it, Sally's address, 5135 Kensington Avenue. So we added that, and I think it's a nice touch.
That's a wonderful touch. I love that verse.
That was her real address.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to skip the verse and start with the melody because we're so limited
you
know, for time.
I really messed you up. That's okay.
I live at 5135 Kensington Avenue, and he lives at 5133.
Hit it.
How can I ignore the girl next door? Doesn't try to please me, doesn't even tease me, and she never sees me glance her way. And though I'm heart sore, the girl next door affection for me won't display. Can't ignore her, the girl next door.
Blaine singing The Boy Next Door, or in that version, The Girl Next Door. We're remembering composer Hugh Martin, who died Friday at the age of 96. The conversation we heard earlier was recorded in 1989. Terry spoke again with Hugh Martin in 2006 as the Christmas holidays were approaching.
Now, you once told a story on our show about how you and your late partner, Ralph Blaine, wrote Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Can I ask you to tell it again?
Well, first of all, I feel rather self-serving admitting this, but Ralph didn't really write it, honey. We wrote our song separately, so it's words and music by me.
Oh, well, good. So now you're really able to tell the complete story.
I can really tell the complete story. Ralph was working in one room, and I was working in another on Meet Me in St. Louis. And I played the first 16 bars of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas over and over and over and got stuck. I couldn't find a bridge for it. And so I just put it aside and decided not to work on it. And Ralph, who had heard it through the walls, came to me the next day and said, whatever happened to that little madrigal-sounding melody that you were playing? And I said, well, I couldn't make it work, Ralph, and so I discarded it. And he said, well, you find it and finish it, because I have a big feeling about it. And so we did find it, and I did finish it, but the original version was so lugubrious that Judy Garland refused to sing it. She said, if I sing that to little Margaret O'Brien, they'll think I'm a monster. So I was young then and kind of arrogant, and I said, well, I'm sorry you don't like it, Judy, but that's the way it is, and I don't really want to write a new lyric. But Tom Drake, who played The Boy Next Door, took me aside and said, Hugh, you've got to finish it. It's really a great song, potentially, and I think you'll be sorry if you don't do it. So I went home and wrote the version that's in the movie.
Now, I should explain that in the 1944 movie musical Meet Me in St. Louis, when Judy Garland sings this, you know, she and her younger sister are very, it's Christmas time, but she and her younger sister are very unhappy because their father's job is taking him from St. Louis to New York, and he's going to move the whole family to New York, and they don't want to go and leave their friends behind. So the younger sister, played by Margaret O'Brien, is crying, and Judy Garland tries to comfort her by singing the song. Now, you said that the first version was lugubrious. What made the lyrics lugubrious?
Well, I'll sing it for you. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last. Next year we may all be living in the past. Pretty sad.
But you changed that lyric, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. The one in the movie was, let's see, have yourself a merry little Christmas. Oh, until then, we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. That was one that was in the movie. Then I got a phone call from Frank Sinatra saying, I'm doing an album called A Jolly Christmas, and I love your song, but it's just not very jolly. Do you think you could jolly it up a little bit for me? So then I wrote the line about, have you hang a shining star upon the highest bough? And Frank liked that and recorded it, and people... They do, sometimes they do that line, and sometimes they do the muddle through line somehow.
I like the muddle through one.
I like the muddle through one better, too.
My guest is songwriter Hugh Martin, and here's Twisted Sister from their album A Twisted Christmas. As you'll hear, they use the line Martin wrote for Sinatra.
Ho, ho, ho! Let's go! Yeah.
Twisted Sister and their cover version of the Hugh Martin Christmas classic. Hugh Martin died on Friday at the age of 96. We'll hear more of Terry's 2006 interview with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with the late composer Hugh Martin. They spoke in 2006 as the holidays were approaching.
Let me ask you to share with us your favorite Christmas memory, since we all have your song playing in our soundtrack of Christmas.
Well, my favorite Christmas memory was of being 6 or 7 years old and my mother decorating the tree. And she was a very artistic woman, and she did sensational Christmas trees. So it was a real joy every year when she would decorate it. And it was a very wonderful moment. That was my favorite Christmas memory.
And what's Christmas like now?
Oh, do I have to say?
You don't.
I'm really upset by Christmas now. I just hate the Santa Claus and the jingle bells and reindeer and the wrapped packages and the holiday push. I hate all of that. I just loved it when it was, all my life ago, 90 years ago.
You liked it when it was less commercial?
Oh, yes. Didn't you? Well, of course, you're not old enough to remember when it was
yeah, I think it was
so beautiful.
Pretty commercial.
But I loved it when it was old-fashioned. We didn't even have electric lights on our tree. We'd have candles.
We're about to hear a version of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas that you recorded a year ago.
That's
and
right.
Was released earlier this year in a CD that's called Hugh Sings Martin.
Right.
And this features recordings that you've made, you know, throughout your career, particularly like in the 40s and 50s.
That's right.
But it has this new recording from a year ago. You made this recording when you were 90?
I was 90 years old. I don't know how I got through it.
and you're at the piano playing and singing. It's quite beautiful. Do you want to say anything about making this recording before we hear it?
Well, I just want to say, Terry, that I never would have continued singing at all if it hadn't been for you, because you did an interview with Ralph and me in 1989, I think it was, when Meet Me in St. Louis opened on Broadway, and you played a little recording of me singing the trolley song, and I was just about to stop singing because I wasn't getting all that much encouragement. But when at the end of the cut you said, "Ooh, I like your singing. I like it a lot," and that thrilled me so but I kept on singing.
Well, it thrills me to hear you say that, and I still
mean
really
it.
Like your singing.
Thank you.
And I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, and I want to thank you for writing such a great Christmas song. Some of those Christmas songs tend to wear thin.
Well, God really
your
blessed
song
me.
Is so enduring. It's just one of the most beautiful and moving, I think, of all the Christmas songs. So thank you so much, and thank you for talking with us again.
Thank you deeply for saying that. Bye-bye.
Here we are, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who were dear to us, gather near to us once more. So a merry little Christmas now.
Composer and singer Hugh Martin. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2006. He died Friday at his home in California. He was 96. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.